This podcast is brought to you with limited interruption by Rudy Luther Toyota. Whether looking for an exciting brand new Toyota, a certified pre-owned vehicle, or getting quality routine maintenance and service for your vehicle, Rudy Luther Toyota is the place to go. Rudy Luther Toyota, the southeast corner of 394 and 169 in Golden Valley.
AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show. Matt, Brett here today. Hey, Brett, how are you?
All right, how about you?
It's one of those days, man. It's one of those days. You and I got it. First of all, there is so much news going on. I mean, I've got special session. As a matter of fact, we got two guests on special session. Dana Ferguson from Forum News Service is going to join us a little bit later on. Senator Susan Kent, the Senate Minority Leader, she's going to join us as well, coming up in the 5 o'clock hour. We'll talk about that. Obviously, coronavirus, I've got a stunning statistic for you about coronavirus right now. That will come up a little bit later on. We can talk what seems to be an epidemic of drowning going on in the state right now. But unfortunately, I mean, I would like to talk about it. I was nice. I felt better. I was able to get out. I was able to do things. I saw In the Heights. I thought this was a great movie and did all these things. And then the story that broke last night. Now, I want to start off because I'm really bothered by how the media immediately went with the truck driver or the Jeep driver, the Jeep Cherokee, that rammed into protesters in Uptown, killing one, injuring others. Because right away, the narrative in pretty much every one of these stories was, well, alcohol and drugs was involved. What was possibly involved? Let me be clear here. Was possibly involved. That was a police spokesperson was putting that out officially as this. We're looking into this now. You want to know the truth? From things I'm beginning to see potentially hear about the individual, and I don't want to verify anything. I don't think they've released his name yet. There have been some Twitter sites and stuff that has put a guy's name out. I'm not sure exactly if that's the right guy. But drugs and alcohol, sure. But if the guy went down with intent into Uptown to ram into some protesters with a car, then you putting out drugs and alcohol as your first call of defense is wildly irresponsible and reckless and just crap. And once again, the guy that they pulled from the car, white guy. And the second the white guy gets out, well, man, drugs and alcohol. Boy, oh, boy. Isn't that a crippling problem in America? Oh, dear Lord. Oh, God, can you believe it? Unless the guy was planning on trying to kill some protesters, because that's called premeditated murder. And for you to even offer this to the white guy who rammed into him, and I'm putting aside the way that the police responded, putting aside the fact that and I'll get to another thing I want to make sure I clarify and stand by here in a second. It was ugly. I want to read you the difference, and I want to give – this is something that Tony Webster over at The Reformer actually pointed out about the coverage between how the Star Tribune was covering the story and actually how what I would call a good news outlet, the NPR news guys, wrote their article. I'm going to read the difference here, okay? Tell me if you can spot the subtle difference, because – there's some information that seemed to be omitted from a lot of other sources. Here is, first of all, the Star Tribune. A man drove into a group of protesters, killing one woman and injuring others in Uptown Minneapolis intersection late Sunday. The incident occurred about 11:40 p.m. at West Lake Street, Girard, near the Winston Boogie Smith Jr., where Winston Boogie Smith Jr. was fatally shot by law enforcement on June 3rd during an attempt by U.S. Marshals Services to force him, a task force to arrest him. The woman died after being taken by ambulance to HCMC. The second protester was also struck by the vehicle and taken to an ambulance. Two more people from the incident later sought medical attention nearby hospitals. The driver was hospitalized for treatment and injuries after the protesters began to strike him, Elder said. This is from police spokesman John Elder. So once again, his injuries came from those protesters attacking him. Conditions of the injured protesters are not meeting known. Police have yet to determine the motive for the driver's actions. However, the use of drugs or alcohol may be a contributing factor in this crash, Elder said. The identity of the driver is being withheld by the police. So what do you have here? You have what sounds like could be just an accident. Guy drives into a crowd. And then those big, mean protesters, they started beating that guy up. Now, hey, we want to make sure for the record we say drugs and alcohol might have been involved. But, hey, I mean, there's a very toned-down version there. Now, that was the Star Tribune, who basically, and I want to make sure I put this in context about how this story was reported. Yesterday, their big story was how Jute Salon was basically saying, because of protesters, we're leaving Uptown. By the way, so long, because I guarantee you some other up-and-coming, spa place will move into your location and no one will remember you. I mean, you'll have the suburban people, but, you know, your prestige location in Uptown will be gone. And trust me, someone's going to take that spot. Anywho, but that was the narrative they ran with yesterday. Those damn protesters. The Jute Salon is gone. Those damn someone got killed. So you put this into context, it almost feels like the Strib was angry that their anti-protester narrative on the Jute Salon story got disrupted because, well, one of them got hit by a car. But boy, they were beating up that guy that drove into him. Now, that is the Star Tribune story. To the people over at NPR, one person was killed, three injured Sunday night after the driver in an SUV drove into a crowd of protesters in the uptown area in Minneapolis near the site where Winston Smith was shot by serious deputies early this month. A witness said the eastbound SUV was moving at a high rate of speed as it approached just before midnight and that the driver appeared to accelerate as they got closer to the demonstrators who had blocked off Lake Street near Girard Avenue. The driver struck a vehicle parked across one of the traffic lanes on Lake Street, apparently positioned to protect the crowd. That second vehicle then hit people. Wow! That almost sounds like a completely different frickin' story, doesn't it? Doesn't sound like we have a guy here who is just, gee willikers, I'm confused. Oh no, I hit someone. No, it doesn't sound like the Strib's version of the events. This guy, it sounds like, accelerated into the crowd, trying to get into one of the cars. So, at the very least, you have a guy who is driving at a very high rate of speed, approaching a parked vehicle across the road. So clearly there was some intent there, because if you saw a vehicle parked across the road, wouldn't you say to yourself, oh, well, I clearly can't go down this lane of traffic. Not this guy. He rammed that like he was trying to get through it, trying to get at the protesters. And eyewitnesses in this story, as they are credited in this story, say he was going fast and he accelerated at the end. This is why this is such crud that the police and the news media in this town ran with the drugs and alcohol, mean protesters, drugs and alcohol, mean protesters. Did this guy have intent? Because it sounds like from this story, you have attempted murder. And it doesn't matter if drugs or alcohol are in there, because isn't that what they say when a black person is accused of attempted murder? Is that, I don't care that he's on drugs. He should have known better. Isn't that it? So for you to even put that argument out there is wildly reckless. And once again, it sounds like he targeted the protesters. This is just crud. I am so damn tired of the narrative driving that is going on in our freaking media today. Yesterday, it's all about those damn protesters, not Jute Salon. Oh, God. Oh, God. Not Jute Salon. And then when you do have what sounds like, when you take a credible news source and actually have the story, a person trying to hit protesters, the translated version is somehow, well, you know, drugs and alcohol. What are you going to do? tired of this crap. Tired of it. This is just manipulative journalism 101. And it's just crap. You don't know what happened here. This guy, and I'm going to be very clear. I don't know if the guy they're identifying is the right guy, because his Facebook page is real weird. And I don't think it's the same guy. But this guy was down there. And if he did indeed speed into the intersection, which the impact information will tell us how fast his vehicle was going. If he did accelerate when he did see the protesters, if he rammed a car to try to get at the protesters, how in the hell do you not control that intent? Oh, white guy. That's right. White guy. White guy did it. Oh, come on, Matt. He was a rapscallion. Come on. He's misunderstood. Did you see the protesters attacked him? That poor guy. Shut up. Because there's a dead person, unfortunately. And unfortunately, this is going to, unless we condemn this with the strongest words, how long till the next clown comes out of the suburbs or out of rural Minnesota driving into our city trying to kill off protesters? The woman, let's talk a little bit about the tragedy here. And this is, loved ones have identified the woman killed late Sunday night in Uptown as Deonna Marie Erickson. Erickson was among the protesters that had crowded around Lake Street and Girard as part of the demonstration against the June 3rd fatal law enforcement shooting of Winston Smith nearby. At around 11:39, a motorist plowed through the gathering with a chaotic aftermath caught on camera. I am going to repeat this. I highly do not recommend you watch that. Four people were injured in the incident, with Erickson's injuries proving to be fatal. Just 24 hours before her death, she had posted on her Facebook page about the significance of the week ahead, noting that she would be marking both her 32nd birthday on Wednesday and 1 year sober on Friday. On Monday morning, her mother shared a photo of Deonna Marie along with a message. Here is my beautiful, brave, funny, everything daughter. Today she was taken from us while supporting other family's cause. The details are in the news and on social media, which I have not watched. It has only been 2 hours since the notification. It only feels like a lifetime. God has you now, sweet poke. I love you to the stars and back a gazillion times. Erickson had been working as a program manager at the Cottage Group, a Burnsville-based company that provides residential accommodation for people with limited mobility. The company said it was shocked and deeply saddened by her death. Deonna was a program manager who dedicated her time to overseeing two of the community resident sites. She put her heart into work. She was one of the most selfless people we have had the pleasure of knowing. She earned the respect and trust of those she served because of her true compassion for her work. She will be deeply missed by those she was served and served with. Erickson was originally from Pine City, according to Facebook page, but living in Minneapolis. Social media post paints a portrait of a young woman who loved her children, her puppy, and her sports, especially the Vikings and wide receiver Justin Jefferson. She's also an outspoken about law enforcement and police shootings. In the days before her death, shared a photo of Smith, adding, "We are going to get change for you and all others. We will get justice. You change the world while you are here, and in your name, a lot more change is still to come." She last Facebook post was when she shared a live stream of a scene in Uptown protest site a few hours after she posted this, referencing the ongoing protesting blocking the intersection by the parking ramp where Smith was killed by undercover law enforcement members. Mother who worked with the needy, celebrating 32nd birthday, sober, with kids, beloved, murdered. 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 There's going to be kind of a little bit of an underlying theme on some of this show today about how there is a failure to protect us from the Republican Party of Minnesota, that we have clear problems here in our state, in our country, in our city. And we have talked about how when you look at how things have gone, that the Minnesota GOP, I made this post this morning. And this is a post I made up on Twitter and on Facebook, on the Twitter page, Matt McNeil Show. Facebook is Progressive Citizen X, Matt McNeil Show. And And I said this, I guarantee you not a single Minnesota GOPer will be one-tenth as bothered or outraged by this man murdering a protester with their vehicle as they are at the people protesting another black man's death at the hands of law enforcement in Minneapolis. Not even close. Took a little bit of brushback, a little. But I stand by that statement. And you know why I stand by that statement? Because, well, first of all, I'm going to be blunt. I'm going to be honest that the Republican Party isn't over there saying, we need to pass an immediate bill to exonerate this guy. Did you hear protesters were there? He got scared. There was a black guy. There was a black guy on the street. He got scared. We need to make sure he's got protections. They pulled him from his car and punched him just for murdering one of their protesters. I'm surprised they haven't. I'm surprised they haven't. I'm surprised. And you know why? We have had tons of problems with police officers murdering black men in the city. We've had tons of problems with police officers being way too aggressive with the minority communities and people overall. Minneapolis police have been kind of jerks for a long time, not kind of big time. And they've murdered people in uniform, wearing a badge. And not one Republican is really willing to go out there and do any real substantial police reform. But protesters block a road. Oh, my God. Those tight, undied little twits from the rural parts of this state who like to scare people with the minorities run over to St. Paul and say, we have got to put the harshest penalties into place to deal with this real threat. Protesters! And they go on out there and they pass bill after bill after bill talking about penalties and jail time and federal charges and put them in the poorhouse and take every dime they've got. Ha, ha, ha. And we're going to make sure when people drive into those crowds that those people are innocent, that they'll never have to go to jail. We'll even give them a guidebook on what you do. Pull four or five blocks away, pull aside and say, I hit some people and we'll let you go. That's what Republicans across the country have done. Because they can't go out there fast enough and vilify minority protesters. But ask them to go on out there and deal with the epidemic of law enforcement's aggressive and lethal actions against the minority community, and they get numb. Nope, not pulling that one back. I guarantee not a single Minnesota GOPer will be one-tenth as bothered or outraged by this man murdering a protester with their vehicle as they are about people protesting another black man's death at the hands of law enforcement in Minneapolis. Not even close. 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. Take a break. Come on back. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. You know, I just, everything about this right now, everything about law enforcement in this city, in the city of Minneapolis, is just going backwards. One of the things which was really weird is this, is that one of the things in the story that I kind of raised my eyebrow as well was, the police said, well, we were monitoring via video. You were what? Okay. I understand you guys are, you know, because apparently people in Minneapolis don't appreciate you murdering George Floyd, that you guys are feeling like you're victims. I get that. I understand. It's the Bob Kroll union mentality, you know, that unless everyone is bowing down and kissing your feet, that basically that they hate you and you're the victim and poor you. I get it. I ain't fine. But you guys are still employed as police officers, right? I mean, it's not like, you know, you're an architect and just one day you decide you're going to come on in here and just watch cable TV all day, right? You know, you still are police officers, right? You guys have, and I understand a lot of police officers because they want to take their toys and go home because apparently, once again, people didn't appreciate the fact that George Floyd was murdered. And once again, before police officers, you know, that you know he was convicted and stuff like that, I still have, outside of a handful of police officers in the Minneapolis Police Department, very few police officers have even said anything negative about what happened and Derek Chauvin. They haven't even said a damn thing. It's pathetic. They should have a spine and be able to say, oh, yeah, murdering a guy is bad, but hey, heaven forbid we cross that bridge, huh? Anyway. But you guys, you got live protesters in a street. You got a street that's blocked. You're in Uptown. This is not, you know, a kind of an up-and-coming neighborhood. This is a fairly wealthy, you know, neighborhood. It's got a lot of shops down there. You know, and as much as the Star Tribune wants to paint it as protesters are making Jute Salon leave, maybe it's the lack of police patrols because they're basically doing everything via video monitor like it's a Zoom call is the real problem. Because I have a hard time believing that if the police officer was there with flashing lights, I don't know, at probably somewhere around Lake Street and Hennepin, knowing that coming up ahead there was some protesters in the streets. Well, I have a hard time comprehending how in the world maybe this guy would have been so brazen. But if all you're doing is video Skyping your patrols, and then when you show up with hyper-aggressive techniques, mainly geared at the protesters, including the dead one and the injured ones. Now, I'm a little... Everything, every law, it's, I don't know what's going on with law enforcement when they get into the city of Minneapolis, but there is just this mentality once you get in here, that State Patrol, Henry County Sheriff, U.S. Marshals, doesn't matter. All of a sudden, it just, the police work goes right down the tube. And I can tell you right now, Minneapolis police, nice job. You just telegraph to any loon ball that wants to kill a protester that basically you're just doing this via Zoom call. So, you know, they'll have a good 10-minute getaway if they can get away. So good thinking, good police work, protect and serve, blah. 952-946-6205. Let's go to the phones. Gary is in Minneapolis. Welcome on in, Gary.
Hi, Matt. Good to hear you.
Good to hear you, sir.
You know what? At least have the majority of the money in the country, and people are going hungry in a mess of poverty. You can easily get people like Mao Zedong and Red China or Castro in Cuba. And we got Roosevelt in the 30s, and Germany got Hitler. So starving people or hungry people, whatever, they'll grab onto anything. They'll pull anything.
All right. Thanks, Gary. 952-946-6205. Lanny is in Minneapolis. Lanny, thanks for holding.
Oh, no problem. I just wanted to mention about you were talking about the media kind of whitewashes stuff.
Yeah.
It was right on your station there, AP. They were mentioning was something going on with the George Floyd incident. And then they mentioned, oh, George Floyd who died in police custody. They didn't mention, of course, that he had.
Well, and you got to remember, and Lanny, if you're talking about the news at the top of the hour, and thanks, Lanny, I appreciate the information. I think, Brett, you and I can, and thanks for the phone call, Lanny. Brett, you and I can attest to this. How many times have we listened to the news sometimes at the top of the hour? It's like, what the hell are these guys talking about?
Yeah, the old play it down the middle.
Yeah,
every day.
Hey, whoa, yeah, no. We'll take that hit. We don't have any control over AP or any of the national news we have. That is them. We do send them notes saying, you're wrong, but they don't listen to us. Heaven forbid, like Bill Maher trying to, you know, the thing he did on Friday night. I could go after him and say, hey, you know, if from a guy that lives in Minneapolis, I think you're way off base. But, you know, don't ever let their narrative get in the way. And plus the fact that, let's face it, nothing makes a lot of journalists worse than a talking chimp like me. I mean, I'm a dancing chimp. I'm a talk show host. Me coming up and trying to correct them, nothing insinuates their, how dare you, more than me saying, well, you're wrong. Really quick. Now, Lawrence, I don't have a lot of time because I got Dana Ferguson. We're going to talk about the special session starting up. But Lawrence and St. Paul, go right ahead.
Hey, thank you. Hey, what I have to say is simple. I travel around this country on a consistent basis. Look, man, you need a national show. You take it right to them. And you're not afraid of them. I like it, man. So keep up the good work, sir.
Thank you. Peace, my friend. Peace. Lawrence in St. Paul, 952-946-6205. We'll take a break. We got to get special session starting off. I got two guests today on this. Coming up a little bit later on, Senator Susan Kent, the minority leader, joining us. Dana Ferguson, Minnesota Capitol reporter for Forum News, joins us next. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show. My pleasure to welcome on Dana Ferguson, the Minnesota Capitol correspondent for Forum News Services. She's kind enough today to take some time to talk about the beginning of the special session. How long will it last? We shall find out. Dana, thank you very much. I appreciate the time today.
Thank you for having me on.
My pleasure. How many special sessions does this make for you now?
Oh, my goodness. I've only been around here for, I think, 3 years now covering the Minnesota legislature, and I want to say this is maybe the 10th, and oh boy, they're not so special any longer.
Yeah, special is the wrong term. It's just a session. It's just a session at this point. We'll start with one of the reasons we were brought into session. Once again, Governor Walz wants to extend his emergency powers. I'm not sure how many more months he wants to go. For sure, he wants one more month at least. It sounds like there is some question of whether he'll take it further past that. But he did want to do that. With that, automatically triggered the special session. Did that vote already happen today? Did the special session get did his emergency powers get extended as well?
They did get extended, and this morning the executive council approved 30 more days of this. The House came in and brought up a motion to consider ending them. I'm sure you already know this, but both chambers have to essentially vote to veto an extension, and they didn't take up the motion that would have triggered that veto. So it looks like another 30 months are on the way. We've heard some different opinions from legislative leaders today regarding when they think that the emergency ought to end. Speaker Melissa Hortman today said the state should take advantage of the federal funding that's available for nutrition assistance. That could come in through September. So she was saying potentially through the end of July, early August, it could end. We heard from Republicans at the Capitol that they'd like it to end much sooner. They have wanted it to end for months now, so that's not a big surprise, but at least 30 more days is what we know.
And there is, you bring up a very good point. There's some nuances with federal funds that, you know, and on both sides. I mean, the Republicans want to have some say in how that money is spent, especially when it comes to small business relief, landlord relief as well. But if the emergency powers are in place, Walz has a lot of the drive, you know, the steering wheel in that case. And so that's part of the question as well, correct?
It is. I think we hear from both sides that they really want to be involved in determining how the state is going to handle COVID, and how the state is going to come out of the pandemic, who gets the most financial assistance, what that looks like. They have different ideas about it, and they would both very much like to be driving the car on that. But at this point, it's still quite a bit in the governor's lap in terms of how at least some of that federal funding is going to the leaders agreed to give him a decent chunk of that, but to take on a separate pool of money on their own and decide through the budget writing process what that might look like. So everybody wants to be in control at the Capitol.
Mm-hmm. Well, and obviously, because this is the real power time, because you're at a point now where the what you get is there was a lot of budget negotiation. So let's actually go back a little bit. The regular session ended. You basically had these work groups, these committee hearings of the Senate leaders and the House leaders. And it was a real mixed bag. Some of these went well. We actually had Jamie Becker Finn on, who was talking about some of the things on her committee that we had her on last week, that her committee went great, that the judicial reform, they hadn't really, there was a lot of agreement. They minor speed bumps, things seem to go pretty well. There's a lot that are not. Talk a little bit about that, because that seems to be where we're going to get into the most contention now that we're into the special session. It's some of these committees that that basically really kind of derailed themselves because of demands, mostly demands by policy demands that were coming in from the Republicans in the Senate.
That's right. There are a few where there were just these very hard-fought positions that were never going to go anywhere in divided government. I'm thinking about the clean cars policy and the environmental budget, and they have Republican leaders said today that that's something they're going to have to fight for out on the campaign trail before those rules would take effect in 2024. School choice legislation around vouchers for private schools that, again, Democrats had said since the beginning of this year that they would never consider. But as recently as last week, we heard the Republican chair of the working group say this has got to be in the education budget. And legislative leaders came in and said, listen, you all knew that this was going to be hard. We have to start taking some of these things out so that we can actually get things done. And so they spent the entire weekend ridding themselves of some of the controversial policy measures in these budgets. And it seems like they're starting to make progress. We heard today that there's a deal on the housing budget, along with the eviction moratorium. That had been debated for months, and there were just so many sticking points, but that's come through, and they're hoping to pass it this week. Just very recently, we saw some news about a tax budget coming through. Speaker Hortman today said transportation and education, K-12, are looking pretty close. So things are coming together. It seems like the public safety and judiciary bill will be one of the last ones to come just because there's so much in it. But folks are feeling pretty optimistic that they will get something done.
Well, and it should be mentioned, as Jamie Becker Finn, the representative, mentioned, the reason why those are two are combined, public safety, judiciary, those because in the Senate, the way the committees are set up, that's why they're combined. But it sounds like most of that's on the public safety side. But do you mind if we go back? Because I want to go back to some things you just said there, and I just want to clarify. So did you get some word that Ingebrigtsen, because once again, on the Environmental Committee, Bill Ingebrigtsen, the Senate leader, Republican, he brought in clean cars, which once again does not have anything to do with his environmental bill. This is a completely separate issue that has been the courts ruled is not part of the legislative purview. He said that unless the clean car rule, which was basically that we're going to sell electric cars, more electric cars in Minnesota. That's all this rule is we're going to try to sell more electric cars in Minnesota. That unless those rules are removed, that he was going to basically torpedo the entire environmental bill, which was kind of goofy because considering most of the state parks, which would be closed immediately with that move, are in Republican rural areas and they need that money. But he seemed to be sticking his heels in the ground. You're kind of giving me the impression that in the Republican leadership might have gone to Ingebrigtsen and said, okay, that's not going to happen.
I can't confirm that they had a conversation about it, but Senator Gazelka today said that that is out at this point. I don't know that Senator Ingebrigtsen is going to continue with the push and be really dug in on wanting to at least delay the clean car standards. But Gazelka today said that they acknowledge that 2024 is when that rule is going to take effect. And before that, we'll have an election. So if that's going to be something voters feel really strongly about, they can change up leadership here at the Capitol. But it doesn't look like it's going to be in the budget at this point.
Vouchers, that was another one that was interesting because it was kind of surreal to a point last week that you had the voucher people screaming, oh, we want vouchers for 8,000 kids. But at the same time, they had to shut down St. Paul schools, Minneapolis schools, sounded like some outstate schools as well because of the heat issue, which affected 70,000 kids. And so, you know, it kind of the question became priorities is that, okay, is the vouchers really the big priority or for 8,000 kids or 70,000 kids that apparently don't have schools that are functionable? You can't have kids learning in a sauna, especially at the end of the year when they're taking finals and tests in that sort of situation. So I don't know if that played a role there, but, you know, is there, I mean, the Democrats are, I'm pretty sure the DFL is not going to cave. The voucher program is not something anyone on the DFL I've talked to, period, has had any appetite at approaching. So that's sounding like, though, the Republicans might put that aside as well?
I think so. And I think they understood that it was a non-starter with the DFL from the beginning of the year. And it's been, it seems like a passion project for Senator Chamberlain. He's been pushing it for several years in different ways. He was at the Capitol last week leading a group of school choice advocates to a press conference where the governor was talking about budget negotiations, and they sort of swarmed around him and were trying to make it look as though he was a supporter of school choice, but he has vocally opposed it and said it just is not going to happen. So there might be chairs who are really passionate about these policy provisions they're bringing forward, but based on what we're hearing from the legislative leaders, those are just going to have to go, because at some point, anything that can't get agreed to in the divided legislature isn't going to be able to cut it, and they just want to get a budget done and get out of here.
And you're right, Michelle's mentioned Benson, Michelle Benson, Senator Benson, the Republicans, also been big on that one as well. You're right. There was an agreement to a point on, and this is a mess. I mean, obviously with the pandemic, what happened. I mean, we got to figure out how we deal with the evictions issue. Landlords do have rights. Renters do have rights. It does sound like, and this was one thing that actually gave me a little, I was okay with. There did seem to be compromise on both sides on that agreement when it came down, when we started hearing the details that were coming out of that bill.
That's correct. And today, talking to the chairs of the working groups in either chamber, they will be the first to tell you they had to give some things up, and they're struggling with it a little bit, but they were able to reach an agreement. They both were very proud of it and excited about it, confident that it is something they can pass out of both chambers. So there's going to be a scaled phase out of the eviction moratorium under the proposal. They're going after the renters who had just broken provisions of their lease first. So people who maybe were causing damage or doing things that they weren't supposed to. And then at the end, sort of a couple of months later, and after giving folks a chance to apply for rent assistance, they're going to ultimately let people know, hey, you might get evicted if you haven't been paying rent, but trying to set out a lot of steps so that folks don't get completely surprised or evicted before having an option to get some assistance and potentially stay where they are.
And that was, and I got to tell the truth, I like how they did that, because they can't just, that was kind of the thing, was either everyone gets thrown out the first day or no one gets thrown out. And I said, okay, that's not going to work. You got to find something. That was good. So I'm going to ask you, if there is a budget, if any of these bills doesn't get passed, if there's one that you are seeing yourself as you're covering this, wow, these guys are entrenched, they are not moving, is there any that's going to come down that even the leadership is not going to be able to budge the committee chairs?
After the past few days, assuming the legislative leaders are living up to their word, I think they're all going to get through. I think public safety and judiciary might be tough just because there's a lot in it, and it will be difficult for them to get through all of it within 7 to 10 days, which is the time frame they said they want to stick to. The other two, if the chairs do dig in and stick with the ultimatums they've given, environment could be tricky, education could be tricky, but we've heard today that they're getting closer now that they're starting to jettison some of the controversial stuff. So maybe silly of me, but I'm feeling optimistic that they will all get done. Just some of them might take a little bit more time because they're larger bills and there's just more to them.
Well, and as you have seen, what happens is when you start giving, and bills are getting compromised, and people, the environmental bill was never going to get compromised. Oh, they did? That does have a tendency of putting pressure on these holdout committees to say, okay, we got, 20 out of 21 done. We need your committee done. And then there is that pressure. And I think at that point, just to get it done so that there's nothing hanging over the legislature, there is that pressure and things kind of get accomplished. You guys have seen that it kind of, once it starts clearing out, it clears out fairly quickly.
Yeah, and we're starting to see that happen. It's been a little bit difficult over the past 3 to 4 weeks just because these groups are meeting in secret.
Yeah.
We don't get a lot of access to the work that they're doing. So when they come out with a spreadsheet or with the bill language, we haven't been privy to what's going on in these conversations. Some of it might be new, but there were 4 finished at the beginning of the day today, and we're already starting to hear about agreements coming through and bills getting wrapped up. So the dominoes are starting to fall. It's all looking like it's going to get done. And all the leaders say that they have no intention of going into post June 30th territory, and they don't want to shut down. So,
and you had a tweet earlier today. Speaker Hortman said she's her impression is this is not going to be one of those running down the hall at 11 o'clock on the 30th trying to get votes done. That this is probably going to wrap up with a few days before the end of June. Correct?
That's correct. Yep, they're hoping to get it done. We heard both leaders today say 10 days is the target. So maybe midweek next week we're done.
Hopefully, hopefully. Then you can enjoy some summertime until the next special session.
Wouldn't that be nice?
You can have the 4th. The next, if they do extend the emergency powers, that will be mid-July. So you get a few weeks.
Goodness.
There you go. I'm going to make sure I post the story from the Duluth News Tribune that you have out on this today. Dana Ferguson, once again, Minnesota Capitol correspondent for the Forum News Service. Dana, by all means, anytime you want, come on back. Please do.
I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Take care. We'll take a break. Come on back. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. We're going to spotlight Dana there. Dana Ferguson from Forum News Services up in Duluth. Duluth! I'm going to go up there in a few weeks. I'm going to go down and check out that new hurricane wall they put up there. You hear about that? Because the storms came in and destroyed that kind of that water wall to protect the canal.
When I think of hurricanes, I most certainly think of Duluth, Minnesota.
There was a picture posted on Lake Superior, and this is where I've always said this: nature always wins. Hmm. The cliff that this wave is hitting is 100 feet tall. It's clearing the cliff, coming straight in off Lake Superior. I said, "That's Lake Superior." Think about that. That's Lake freaking Superior, and they're able to get that thing. That thing is coming in that big, that hard. It's just scary how big that lake is. And if it wants to mess with you, it will. It will, and it will very quickly. So apparently they did the whole water wall down there.
Really? Okay.
So I'll take a picture. Hey,
yeah.
This is such an old guy tourism thing. Look at the rocks.
Get you the binoculars around your neck. Used
to be partying all night long in the bars, but hey, look at this infrastructure program they passed. How lovely is that?
I mean, the pressure's on with that calendar you made. I mean, the photos you got to take now.
Matt's collection of Duluth rocks. There it is, next year's calendar. this was a weird story just because one of the other radio stations in town, this one of the sports stations, had apparently one of their employees, this is a family member of, and there was a lot of accusations last night that were flying around in regards to the motivations of the person that hit this person with the car. This is up in Brooklyn Park. Neighbors in a Brooklyn Park subdivision say the suspect who hit and killed a man on Saturday night terrorized their neighborhood with his abusive and threatening behavior. According to police, officers responded to the 9500 block of Scott Circle North on reports of a car hitting a pedestrian around 10:30. The victim, identified by family as Paul Pfeiffer, was pronounced dead at the hospital. A police spokesman said while the motive is still under investigation, they believe the driver did hit the man intentionally. He has been held at Hennepin County Jail on criminal vehicular homicide charges. This is weird. The guy was a threat and he was unpredictable, said neighbor Ariel Wright. Wright, 19, said the suspect stole her car out of her driveway on June 15, 2020, hit her as she was pulling away, resulting in injury. Another neighbor told Fox 9 that the past Friday, he approached her with what appeared to be knives wrapped in a towel. She said she called police and they responded, but nothing ever came of it. There are plenty of signs, said Wright. The fact that someone had to die for him to be locked up is really disheartening. Oh, don't worry. If he was black, I'm going to guess he's white, because if he was black, he would have been locked up. I mean, the stealing of the car alone would have been, he'd been in jail for 10 years at that point. But, you know, this is... yeah, the suspect, I don't have an age on him. But God, this guy sounds like he's broken from freaking reality. Court records found the suspect who is charged with aggravated robbery in the incident involving Ariel Wright. Judge found him incompetent to stand trial. So you just released him back into the wild? What are you doing? Brooklyn Park Police say charges expected Monday in this latest case. Pfeiffer leaves behind his husband, whom he was married for 16 years. Friends say the couple moved into their Brooklyn Park home 2 years ago. This is, and obviously some, like I said, there was a little bit of a celebrity thing because of the, they're one of the people that works at a different radio station in town, one of the sports stations, was saying that this was a member there, was their uncle. And so, but once again, I gotta, the way the media covers things, here you have this case. I mean, my God, here is this guy. He stole someone's car and tried to hit them with it. He's walking up to people with knives and towels. Who is this guy? How in the world is this person allowed to be out in public? And when he gets in front of a judge, I mean, the judge just says, well, I don't want to deal with him. Well, then if he's incompetent to stand trial, for God's sakes, get him into a mental facility so he can be evaluated so that we can determine whether or not it's safe to put him on the street. Because in this case, you put him back on the street, and guess what happened? He immediately goes and gets a car and, well, not immediately, but he goes and gets a car and he kills someone. And will that same judge now come on out and say, well, you know, he's incompetent to stand trial. I guess we send him back home so he can kill someone else? God, the system is right now. The system in this state is so broken. But good news, folks. The Minnesota GOP won't fix the damn thing. We're back. Hour two. Senator Susan Kent up next. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. This is Matt McNeil show for your Monday. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. Matt, Brett in today. Our next guest is someone returning to the show. The minority leader for the Minnesota Senate is Senator Susan Kent, Senate District 53. She's kind enough today to take some time to talk about the beginning of the special session. Senator, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Hi there. It's good to be with you again.
Good to be with you. How has today gone? Obviously, we knew this was going to be coming here. How have you felt the first day here has rolled out?
Well, you know, it was a little anticlimactic. We went in, we sort of set ourselves up for a special session, and we adjourned. you know, I will say I wish we had a bit more of a sense of urgency, but I understand, you know, that the negotiations are continuing, and but I just keep saying we definitely have until June 30th to get this done so that we can avoid a shutdown, which we completely need to avoid having. But the closer we get to that date, the more that all these agencies are doing, the people who work there, to prepare for a shutdown that we all think isn't going to happen. And that's a lot of time and a lot of taxpayer money for something that we all hope doesn't happen. So we need to get the work done soon. So I'd rather be there doing it than sitting at home on a summer afternoon.
I would agree with you. I want, you know, it's nice to get this some definition here. One thing I did want to touch on was the extension of the emergency powers for Governor Walz. I'm not going to be shy. I thought he's done a magnificent job leading the state. I agreed with another 30 days for sure. For where are you at here? I mean, your colleagues in the House basically prevented a vote from happening on a procedural move, so he's got the 30 more days. But where are you at? Are you feeling like this needs to go further, or are you feeling like we should start maybe looking at an end game when it comes to the governor's powers?
So I want to back up just a second, because I think through over the past year and however many months, there have been some confusions. There are the emergency powers themselves, which he has always made the analogy that that's like having the toolbox.
Yes.
And then there are the executive orders he's enacted under those emergency powers. So the mask mandate, the policies, the guidelines for schools, for businesses, for, you know, gatherings when things were really bad. There have been a bunch of other very processy things that have to do with being able to move state employees around, that kind of stuff that's real inside baseball, obviously. Most of those are gone now, right? Most of the executive orders are done. The powers still exist. And there are a few things that until we can make sure these are taken care of, we run a risk if we get rid of those powers too early. And one of those that we've talked a lot about is the eviction moratorium. And that if we turn off the emergency powers, we turn off that eviction moratorium. And so even though there's a whole bunch of federal money coming through, not fast enough, but renters and landlords are counting on that federal money, well, once that eviction moratorium happens, people can just be evicted even if the check's literally in the mail, right? And so we need to negotiate, and I think we're getting very close to negotiating an eviction moratorium off-ramp so that we don't have to just shut it off. It can extend under certain criteria while people are getting that money and everybody's getting caught up, so we don't have a whole bunch of people thrown out on the street. The other big thing is SNAP funds. These are federal dollars.
Yes.
That are supplemental nutrition for Minnesota families who really need it. $40 million a month is scheduled to come in September. And we're trying to figure out if there's
Senator, you kind of broke up there a little bit. You're talking about the SNAP dollars coming in about $40 million coming in?
Yeah, $40 million a month until the end of September. And that is tied to an emergency declaration. So if we get rid of the emergency powers, we say bye-bye to $40 million of very important food support a month. And we're trying to figure out how we can do that. And then the other part is if one of these, you know, new variants of the virus were to come up and cause problems, we want to make sure that the governor has the ability to act efficiently and respond with more testing, more vaccinations, that kind of thing. So these are the kind of main buckets of things we're focusing on to make sure that we're in good shape before we're comfortable letting those powers end. Because it is close, for sure. We're just not there yet.
Well, and that money is there, too. And I know Republicans wanted to get some say in how that money is spent as well. But I think Governor Walz has done a magnificent job. Getting back to the post-regular session, pre-special session, you and I talked about 3 weeks ago. How much have you talked outside of, you know, niceties, if even that, with the Senate Majority Leader Gazelka? Has there been any real communications between Senate Republicans and any Senate DFLers?
Yes, there have been. And in fact, I had a very, you know, helpful conversation with Senator Gazelka this morning before we went to session. And, you know, I know that, as they call it, the tribunal? Is that what we're calling that this year? You know, they've been working and they're trying to help unstick the negotiations when they can and do all that sort of stuff. So I'm getting reports from our committee leads and others, you know, so negotiations have been happening. And certainly Senate DFLers and Senate Republicans, and also obviously with House DFLers, you know, there are definitely negotiations happening, good conversations, and progress is being made. I'm just, you know, frustrated it's taken this long. I don't know why we always have to do this to the last possible minute.
Oh, I've got an idea, and I'll get to that in a sec.
So do I.
We'll get to that in a second. One of the things which has been somewhat wild is the way that, and once again, and I want to remind everyone, Senate DFLers wanted to basically say, you can't be part of a white supremacist organization and be a police officer. Republicans voted in unison against that because they said policy has no place in budget bills. That being said, now we have Ingebrigtsen trying to derail the environmental bill with the clean car energy. We have a war on the Minnesota Historical Society of all things. Yeah. You have the people that are trying to force vouchers down, the policy issue of vouchers into the education bill. You have a lot of these Senate Republicans where this is as all of a sudden, which they said that was their standard. You can't put policy issues into budget bills. Now everything that's being held up or has been held up at this point, a lot of it has been dealt with because of Republican senators demanding policy issues now be incorporated into these budget bills. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, I think you've summed it up really well. I'll just throw in there, though, that like vouchers, for example, would over time divert up to $300 million, I think, a year from our public schools. So, you know, there are definite budget implications in all of this. You're so right. You know, Senator Lemmer is always very clear in the judiciary bill that he doesn't want any policy in it. He accepted, he has policy. He had policy in his original bill. He accepted some amendments that had policy, but then he chose not to accept others for his own reasons, including the white supremacist language that you mentioned. And then there's these other things, like saying that the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency can't actually have a policy that controls pollution, which would be the Clean Cars Rule. But, you know, I just think that they're trying to make a stand. They're playing to their base, let's be clear, because any compromise is a complete betrayal in their mind. There was somebody, you know, we had people back in the Capitol today, which was really very exciting. There was somebody there who had a sign with a picture of a jellyfish, and I can't remember the exact line, but it was basically, you know, a stiffer spine than Paul Gazelka. So.
Well, I'll leave that one there. do you mind if we go back to one specific bill, though? You brought up education. And I had Dana, yeah. Dana Ferguson on from Forum News Service last hour, and we were talking about that bill. I think it completely and totally undermines their desire to say, we want 8,000 kids to get vouchers so they can get their private school tuition paid for by the taxpayers. On the same exact day that the entire school district of St. Paul had to shut down, most of the school district of Minneapolis, rural school districts had to, because the schools were so hot, their buildings are so substandard that kids are basically trying to learn in a sauna. And when you have 75,000 kids that can't even go to school because the buildings are that bad, it kind of takes the wind out of your sails about the need for 8,000 kids to get the taxpayers to pay for their kids' private school education.
I couldn't agree more. Let's be clear. These are the people who were so bent out of shape that, you know, we weren't letting kids go to school because we were afraid of a virus that could potentially kill or make them very sick, or their teachers and staff or their families. But no, it's okay to close the schools because we have substandard buildings and we don't want to deal with that. That's a really great point, which, by the way, last I checked, air conditioning usually includes ventilation. Keep everybody healthier too.
Well, you would think, you know, if, heaven forbid we bring the buildings up to, you know, say 1940 standards of code. So,
right.
Exactly. All right. So here's where the tricky part gets. We're hoping this is, and I think it was the speaker brought up the point that she doesn't feel as if the negotiations are going to go to the last second like they usually do, because that's a Republican standard. And we have had multiple times where a bill is agreed to, that the bill goes to get rewritten so it gets voted on, and someone goes in there and takes something out or adds something in. I'll give two great examples. One, when we had the bill that the internet companies could not sell your personal history, someone basically, which was passed pretty much unanimously, someone went in there and purposely yanked that one bill out on their own, out in the middle of the dark, in the middle of the night. The most common one is Kurt Dowd, when he was the speaker, double-crossing all the Democrats he'd lied to with the Southwest Light Rail line, pulling it out. And when your colleague, Senator Ron Latz, caught that, the Senate quickly voted back in. He gaveled the House, crows, ran. Governor Dayton took care of him later. But needless to say, this is, I think, at this point, the most important, one of the most important roles, especially the Senate DFLers and all DFLers have, is holding these Republicans to these standards, because that's a technique they're going to use. And I have zero doubt every one of these bills, someone's going to try to sneak in there and add language or remove language that's going to give them a benefit. Are you guys ready to go over all those bills very closely?
Well, the good news is we will be, and I, you know, I will give credit here. We're going to have hearings in the Finance Committee. We will have hearings, you know, for all the budget bills. We will have the tax bill will be heard in the Tax Committee, and I'm under the assumption we'll ultimately have a bonding bill that will get heard in the Bonding Committee. We just, when we organized today, we created those committees. And so that gives all of us and our staff through the bills to hear them and ask questions. And then, you know, if changes are made over time, clear those out. So it's less of the just big the last minute, we don't know what we're getting, surprise, makes it, you know, just that much easier to track.
It does, but gosh, they're consistent, aren't they?
like the Bondi bill that you're talking about, nobody saw that until 15 minutes before. I mean, that's the problem with that, is when you get those bills that are drafted, thrown on the floor, you know, take it or leave it. And in a bonding bill, you're asking people to leave potentially really important projects in their communities. And so that's why that's done that way. And it's, you know, because those bills have to start in the House, that's when those happen, that's the way that works. And then they get sent over. And in that case, like you said, the House adjourned, sine die. So all we could do was pass it or kill it. And so, but now, you know, if things hold the way they are appearing to be working right now, we will have time to go through these bills, to see what's in them, to see what's in the amendments, and to be able to respond. It's not like we're going to get, you know, the so-called omnibus prime, 1,000 pages dumped on us basically unseen at the last minute.
Two last things, Senator Susan Kent, the Senate Minority Leader, joining us. Senator, there are two things here I want to ask you about. Is one is, do you ever want an intent to sit down with Senator Leader Gazelka and say, hey, here's the deal, in 2024 when I take over, and I'm in charge, and you come hat in hand to me, do you want me to treat you like you treated us? Whether it would go back to that November stuff with the coronavirus, not telling you guys there was a major outbreak within the party, the way that they've disrespected the DFL leadership in the Senate and kind of steamrolled a lot of things there. Do you ever want to sit down and say, I don't want to have a contentious relationship, but the way you treat, how am I supposed to come back now and just give you carte blanche to be part of the process when you basically were so one-sided to us?
It's really funny you ask that, because yes, I've had a lot of those mental conversations over the past year and however many months. I have had occasions like the commissioner drama last summer.
Yeah.
Some bills that have been thrown on the floor with no notice to us, that kind of thing. I had one recently about who they put on a conference committee instead of putting who would have been our natural representative. They handpicked somebody else against my objections. And I said, this will not be forgotten, to answer that particular question, first of all, I'll say, the speculation is that he's going to be running for governor. So I don't think he'll be around in 22, in the Minnesota Senate, but, to the bigger conversation about how we handle that, I don't usually quote Ronald Reagan, but one of the ones that I did like was trust but verify. And, I would like to structure some systems where we say, if we can do things a certain way, particularly when it comes to anything that's public facing, we're not going to play games about hiding bills, not giving hearings, not letting other members ask questions, not letting members offer amendments. I mean, they're just things that are integral to the process of legislating that I don't think we should play games with. But I do think that if we can't deal with them in a forthright basis, then I think as the majority, we will have tools at our disposal to make sure that we can work in a fair way. We respect the power of the minority to have a voice, to offer amendments, to be heard. I mean, that's the American system. That's what's being forgotten right now in Washington, D.C., for crying out loud. In the Minnesota legislature, in the Minnesota Senate, we should absolutely be better than that. But you have to be prepared to play a little hardball to make it happen.
Then the last thing, redistricting. I can do math. The cities are going to pick up. They're going to pick up a few Senate seats and a bunch of House seats. They're just, the math is there. I mean, the cities have grown. The first ring suburbs have grown. These are DFL strongholds. I imagine there's a little bit of hesitancy to even bring this up yet, but that's going to come down the line here. How are you expecting that to start unfolding?
Well, we introduced a bill in the Senate that outlined principles, and that sounds like kind of a nothing or vague or whatever word, but it is the priorities by which those decisions should be made, and that there should be hearings on those principles. Like, you know, do we want to keep them so that they're contiguous? Do we want to observe city lines and county lines and that kind of thing? I mean, they're just communities of color and other communities of interest, for example. So we're hopeful that after we get this budget done on time soon, that we can really turn our attention more to that. We can have hearings with public input and public testimony about the principles and about these issues about, wait, these communities, like, for example, you know, how do we handle tribal territories and making sure that we are not undermining their political strength and voice if we split them into multiple Senate districts, for example. And so there's a long list of those. And we can have that testimony. We can listen to the public, even if we are not in regular session. The data is going to be delayed. We know until September when it's officially delivered. And we can still do the work and do some maps. And we will be reconvening January 31st. And the deadline's not till February 15th. So if we're serious about this and we want to be thoughtful about it, we can absolutely do it. But, you know, history is what it is, and we shall see. But we're going to do it in good faith and try to do our job.
I have most faith in you. You're one of my favorite politicians ever. I really do. I do love you in leadership. I'm glad you were there. I think you and I, let's try to find some time when we get to see what the GOP maps look like, where you and I can just sit and laugh and laugh and laugh.
Well, you're right. There is a lot of math in this one that's pretty hard to argue with.
Yes, exactly. So there
is. It will be interesting to see. Yes. And I would love to sit down with you and have that conversation, Matt. Anytime.
Maybe we'll do an event, listener event. We'll unveil the maps and we'll all get a good chuckle.
Oh, yes.
The Senate Minority Leader for the Minnesota Senate is Susan Kent. This is Senate District 53. Senator, always a pleasure. Come back anytime. We'll talk to you soon, okay?
You too, Matt. Thank you so much.
Take care. Susan Kent, kind enough to have her with us today. Oh, wow. Just a big fan. We'll take a break. Come on back. Spotlight that interview. We're going to be returning in a moment on AM 950. Yeah, my guess is that first GOP redistricting map is going to have like one Minnesota Senate seat for the entire city of Minneapolis and like nine for Chaska. they're going to break Rochester into like 14 different districts to try to basically get rid of the Democratic vote down there. They got a huge math problem. And the problem is this, is that you, even if you start from the population center and move out, or if you start from the where the rural communities have lost people or move in, there's no way you can't move these House and Senate seats towards the cities. And that's a big problem for them. And they will try to do that Texas where they broke Austin into, what, seven different districts so that Austin doesn't have a Democrat. Or I think they got one Democrat now. But they don't have – most of their city is not represented by Democrats. They're represented by Republicans in outlying districts that basically take part of their downtown. So I won't be surprised by that, but we'll have to see, because I can tell you right now, they put the guy – I think he's a rookie senator – out of Minnesota 1, very northwestern part of the state, that's the guy they put in charge. And that's not being written by him. It's been written by someone else. And they're sitting in rooms right now trying to say, well, if we bring this apartment building in, then I will get this. And, you know, they're trying to figure this out. But you're going to have to move at least 8 House seats in towards the Metro Core. You're going to move at least 4, maybe 5 Senate seats into the Metro Core. And, well, we can do math, can't we? That basically becomes the Democratic Senate, the Democratic House, and that's the world you're going to have to live with. Welcome to Oregon. 952-946-6205. Hey, get people to move out there. That's not our fault. People like living in the cities. It's a nice place.
I wonder if they don't get the maps they want, if they'll revive their West Dakota state or whatever they were calling that again.
Why hasn't Munson left? Go, seriously, leave us. Take us and go to South Dakota. We'll just keep the eastern part of the state. We'll have so much more money than you guys. Oh, my God. We have been subsidizing your counties that just do not deliver any tax revenue. And you guys are all the sick counties. I'm sure South Dakota will love that. And, yeah, oh, No, go. Why hasn't he gone?
You know what'll happen? We have these perfect maps, but then the judges made us redraw these things, and now we need to go to South Dakota because the maps are unfair.
Why won't they let us have 3,000 people per Senate seat in the rural parts of the state so real Americans have a voice? And those traitors to America in the metro. Why don't they have 76,000 people per Senate seat? Come on, that's just fair. That's going to be them. Hey, but good news is, in the Republican Party, there's a little strife. Now, you've heard me talk about the orc, David Ozmeck, Senator Dave Ozmeck. The orc. Now, the reason I call him the orc, he is one of the most far-right dudes out there. And the rumor has it, he was the guy that went and pulled that language out. I was talking with Senator Susan Kent. The rumor was that he might have been the guy that pulled the language out about the internet stuff, about them selling your stuff, that he on his own did that. Which, I never got a confirmation on that, but I mean, that's I'd heard that. I don't know for sure. But you know, if you're making you're a Republican, and or if you're on the right and you're making Ozmeck mad, Senator Dave Ozmeck, who occupies the furthest right of the Senate Republican Caucus, has a habit of being very blunt in his communications by the email on the floor of the Senate. He let loose on someone who wrote to him and accused him of being soft on Governor Walz's emergency powers. His target was Representative Eric Mortensen, skin tag himself, Representative Republican from Shakopee. Is he still a Republican, though? He's not part of the Republican caucus. He's not part of the Uber-Allis caucus. I mean, which caucus is he part of, anyway?
Why don't we convince him to start his own party, the Trump Party?
Oh, he kind of is at this point.
That could be successful.
Who is so far right, he's his own caucus in the House. Mortensen has got a hold of an email and blasted it out to his supporters. Here's Ozmeck. This is Ozmeck. This is Dave Ozmeck. This is one of the most far right Republicans in the Senate. Eric Mortensen is the village idiot. Fight. He goes on to explain that Senate has repeatedly voted to repeal Walz's emergency powers, the bill he have authored to change the emergency power statute, go forward. In his conclusion, you are apparently part of the Mortensen Ignorance Brigade, who believe that only St. Eric is doing something in St. Paul. Do yourself a favor and stop displaying your own ignorance. Wow. Mort's response, Ignorance Brigade. It sounds like Hillary Clinton when she called Trump supporters basket of deplorables. Now, I am very hesitant to say this, but Mortensen is kind of right on that. Because if that was a Democrat calling the Republicans Ignorance Brigade, there would be wall-to-wall coverage in this town about how dare they disrespect the salt of the earth people. How dare they?
All the think pieces we'd have Democrats can't reach rural voters anymore.
Why we hate you justifiably. That would be the articles.
Yeah.
Oh, Ignorance Brigade. Well, can we just stop calling it the Minnesota GOP and just call it the Ignorance Brigade? Because, I mean, let's face it, truth in advertising. 952-946-6205. Mwah! Big kiss for you, Ozzy. We'll take a break. Come on back. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. And you missed one thing about the music. The music, man. Crooner's got great music over there.
Best jazz music in the Twin Cities.
It is. And great food, great jazz. We love going over there. We've done a lot of events over there. Why do we like doing events over there? They're fun. And let's face it, if you're going to do something now especially it's cooling down a little bit after those 90-degree days, if you're going to go out and do something fun, why not go get some great music, great dinner, maybe a little dancing? Nice. Go over to Crooner's. Fantastic.
Great views of the lake.
It's nice. And it's just and you want to know if you're just looking for, okay, where do I go for my first time? Go to Crooner's. It's easy. It's so easy. Perfect, too. And one of our favorite places. 952-946-6205. Remember, Brett, I've got a stat coming up here in just a few minutes on the coronavirus update that is going to blow your mind. And if it tells you any, this is the biggest warning sign I can give to anyone. We'll get to that in a little bit. But I want to start off in this last half hour with the disturbing but predictable ruling. The Minnesota Court of Appeals delivered a blow to the opponents of the Enbridge Line 3 pipeline Monday with a decision affirming a key permit for the $3 billion project. Opponents hope the court would halt construction response to legal challenges by the White Earth Nation, Red Lake Nation, and the State Department of Commerce, and several environmental nonprofits. The 337-mile pipeline is on track to be completed at the end of 2021, following 6 years of review. Once again, going to take Canadian oil through our state to ports, not deliver it, not going to give us any damn thing. Minimal long-term jobs, if they're even Minnesota jobs, because let's face it, they haven't delivered on the Minnesota jobs they promised. They've been all a bunch of out-state jobs, not been as many union jobs. It's been crap. And it will likely pollute the crap out of the state of Minnesota. So, yeah, you were hoping that common sense would rule, but apparently not. And by the way, once again, I wanted to say this to anyone out there who's like, jobs! Shut up. If you really want jobs, you'd be down in the cities demanding light rail expansion everywhere in this town, because those are not only local jobs, not only union jobs, but there's a far larger amount of long-term jobs with that. But if that's not good because of those metro people, you should be demanding that the federal government build 3 brand new foundries in this country. Because if we built some foundries where we could make some steel, all of a sudden all of our taconite would be in demand, and the taconite mines, which already exist, would be at full operation. Plenty of jobs for long term, too, that don't involve basically giving a bunch of money and giving carte blanche to a bunch of Canadians and foreign oil buyers. But hey, no, don't let reality get in the way of your stupid, ignorant narrative. Please, I'll let you go. Anyway, the decision will surely intensify opposition to the pipeline, which has been building since construction started in December. The decision today comes out from the Minnesota Court of Appeals is disappointing, but a fight for our water and what our water rights continue, says Tara Hauska, founder of the Indigenous Advocacy Group. GNIW Gnu Collective. I'm sorry. During a news conference on Monday, our resistance is clearly growing. We cannot stop. I'm going to just say this, and I know that Native Roots Radio, those guys are going to come on, and they're going to be justifiably outraged, justifiably angry, justifiably disappointed. But isn't this really the way that this goes? Eventually, you know, treaties override everything. They're supposed to override everything. And the Native Americans are supposed to have sovereign rights where they have the ability to pick and choose who pollutes their land and not, God forbid. But these lower court rulings are all it is a stall tactic. So whether they can get this thing built so that eventually when this does get before a court where it can say, boy, yeah, you sure violated the Native Americans' treaties rights, waggy, waggy, waggy finger, then the people behind it can give out to the Native American tribes another, we're very, very sorry for violating your sovereign rights again, because this is the technique. Oh, we'll give you $750. There you go. Sorry. But they're not going to clean up the mess. As a matter of fact, is any of these groups that have advocated for this pipeline, when these pipelines start leaking and all of a sudden the companies don't want to pay for the cleanup, are they going to come step forward, the people that advocated for this? All of a sudden, they're going to be, oh, he doesn't think this would going to be a problem. Yeah, because you purposely ignored that issue. Now, I'm tired of this. I am tired of the way, this is the new way of abusing the Native Americans, to basically just tie it up in court to where eventually when they're found to be right, that the Native Americans should have had a right and been able to say, no, we don't want this on their land. That basically, well, what are we going to do now? The pipeline's there. It's another massive disappointment. It's another massive failure. And once again, we just had the story in the paper on Saturday that said, because climate change is happening, because of fossil fuels, we're losing the freshwater oxygen in our lakes, which is going to kill our freaking lakes. But God forbid, I guess all these pro people can just go scream at the dead fish floating in the water and say, it's a myth. Tired of it. So angry. I mean, it just, when are you guys going to start caring? And then, of course, the minute all of a sudden this, we realize, oh, God, we've really destroyed the planet. We're really in big trouble. All these people are going to be like, why are you playing the blame game? Because you ignorant morons knew this was going to happen, and you took the money over common sense. Tired of you clowns. Anyway. I won't do it justice. Native Roots Radio, they're on the air. Robert Pilot, the whole crew, listen, 6 o'clock. If you're not listening every night, you're wrong. They're fantastic. 952-946-6205. Coronavirus update for today. We got to get into this because I got a stat here which will blow your mind. Monday's COVID-19 update from the Minnesota Department of Health includes 118 new cases and 5 new deaths. The state's death toll is 7,517 since the start of the pandemic. Of the total deaths, 59.4 were residents of long-term care, but that number is actually down dramatically since that number has come down. I think they were near 70 at one point. The vaccinations in the elderly community really did a great job. I think when you see that number has coming down 10 points, that's good.
Oh, early on, we did a great job getting them vaccinated.
Yeah. Oh, God, I'm so glad we did. The greatest generation didn't deserve that. They didn't deserve that. Through no one does. No one does. Please, come on. I want everyone to live here, all right? Through June 12th, the state reported that 2,998,200 people have received at least one dose of the COVID-19 vaccine. 2,755,522 people have completed the vaccination series. Based on age group, 12 to 15, 33%. They just started that, so that's getting up there. 16 to 17, 47. 18 to 49, that's a little bit of a large group, but that's 56. 50 to 64, 70. And 65 plus 90, total population right now. Total population, which I'm going to includes the kids, the below 12, is 54%. I believe we're at 65% now vaccinated, pretty close to there. Hospitalizations for June 11th. Number of people that were with COVID hospitalized in Minnesota was 178. Of those hospitalized, 48 were intensive care, 130 receiving non-ICU treatment. Hospital admissions involving COVID patients in Minnesota dropped to 223 on March 7th before rising to 699 on April 14th. The 118 positivity results on Monday dispute update were 11,697 completed tests, creating a test positivity rate of 0.1%. According to the Johns Hopkins University site, Minnesota's test positive over the past 7 days, only 1.44%. That's pretty good. That's really good. News from the University of Minnesota, they will not require students, staff, and faculty at any of its 5 campuses to be vaccinated against COVID-19 in the fall semester. University President Joan Gable announced the university system's decision on Monday morning, noting both the excitement and concern of people having the prospect to return to relatively normal campus life. In explaining the decision, Gable cited the guidance from public health, infection vaccination rates in communities surrounding each campus, the expectation now that the COVID-19 vaccines will be authorized for use in kids 5 to 11 come this fall, insights from the university's internationally renowned public health and medical experts, and consultants with students and staff and faculty. I'll go with the medical experts. I don't know if you're aware of this, but U of M, you got some pretty smart docy dudes over there. I'd go trust those guys. A lot of research guys. Also, if you need something, go down to Rochester. They got a good hospital down there. Right here.
Oh, I hear they have one.
Yeah, delicious sandwiches, too. Get the mail. Sorry.
Oh, you couldn't resist.
Put ham on 5, hold the mail. I'm sorry. I saw an airplane not too long ago. The University of Minnesota is not requiring COVID immunization. It's breaking from some other Minnesota universities. Mitchell, Hamline School of Law, McAllister, and Carleton have all said they will require students and staff to be vaccinated. It's challenging to address everyone's individual circumstances through any single university-wide approach. Vaccination is no different. It is complex and a personal issue. Now, that being said, you ready to buckle in, kids? This is an NBC story. Our friend Molly Beck over at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel posted this one. I saw this story. I saw this and I could not believe it. But I can believe this. There are only 3 COVID-19 patients in Sandra Atlas Bass Heart Hospital in North Shore University Hospital on Long Island, New York. A far cry from the hospital, which is part of the Northwell Health Series, has had as many as 600 patients during the peak of the pandemic. I mean, they were shipping them out of New York City into any rural suburban hospital they could in New York for a while there. All 3 patients who are in the intensive care unit have one thing in common, said Dr. Hugh Casseray, director of the hospital's critical care services. They're all unvaccinated. The trend appears to be occurring...
Unvaccinated.
Unvaccinated.
Wow.
The trend appears to be occurring nationwide at hospitals. I haven't had anyone that's been fully vaccinated become critically ill, said Dr. Josh Dennison, a pulmonary medicine and critical care physician at Tulane University in New Orleans. It's been the same for Dr. Ken Lin Q, a pulmonologist and critical care department at Denver's National Jewish Health. None of our ICU patients have been vaccinated. Unvaccinated children, too, seem to be at an increased risk for severe illness. Our local hospitals, the kids that are getting sick are the ones that are not vaccinated, said Dr. Natasha Burgett, the pediatrician at Overland Park, Kansas, and a national spokesperson for the American Academy of Pediatrics. Thanks to the COVID vaccines, number of patients hospitalized has plummeted from more than 125,000 on average in early January to just over 15,000 on average this week. The vaccines are working really well. I'm not saying it's complete. And once again, this is just a few hospitals, but we are seeing an undeniable trend. The people who are being administered to the hospital with COVID are the ones who have not been vaccinated. If that is not your motivation right now, I don't know what it is, but that's not Long Island. That's not New Orleans. That's not Denver. That's Minneapolis, St. Paul. It seems to be everywhere. The people who are getting sick right now with COVID are the ones who are not vaccinated. For God's sakes, people, what else do you need to see? What else do you need to see? And the reality is, we talked about this a little bit last week. We're giving them free. Just go get the shot. It's free. They're everywhere. Get the vaccination. Stop with your freaking Facebook fantasy world that you're magnetized or there's microchips or you're going to get beam powers. Oh, I'd love beam powers. Oh, cook some popcorn right here on the table in a heartbeat.
I mean, it was pretty cool last week when you were sticking stuff to your forehead.
Oh, God, man. I went out to the sculpture garden. Can I tell you what a nightmare that was for a while? Oh, my God. I'm on one of those dangly ones flipping around going, someone get me down. You paranoid, deranged fools. Stop. You're pathetic. This is called a fact. The vast majority of people that are in hospitals right now with coronavirus have not been vaccinated. So as you try to impregnate yourself with a key through your forehead, stop it. Just go get vaccinated. I don't want you to die. I don't want you to have years worth of debt because of hospital bills. Don't be stupid just to be stupid. They're free. And here, if there's once again, and I said this last week, eventually we're going to stop. Eventually, we're going to stop offering this for free, and you're going to have to pay for shots, and you're going to have to pay for care, and all this stuff is going to be gone. And then some rural district where some Republican has been downplaying coronavirus is going to be out there and get a massive outbreak. And they're going to be like, why isn't the state helping me? Because you had a chance, and you told us repeatedly to blank off. And so we left. And so now, all of a sudden, that you're in a crisis, you want help. No. Just get vaccinated, you fools, you fools. I've just got like, it's yeah. How about that for, we're starting to see that nationwide. The only people who are getting admitted to hospitals are unvaccinated people. What else do you need to see? What else do you need to see? And that was one of the stories was Kamala Harris, the vice president over in South Carolina saying, it's free, go please, just go. Get done. Don't know what else we can say to you. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. We'll take a break. Come on back. Rehash the gun story from this weekend when we do return. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the Progressive Voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show. I do want to bring up a story from this weekend. This is a Star Tribune story. In May, Sarah Jane Elwood bought 47 guns. 47 in May. 47. That would be more than one a day, if you ask me. I don't know math really well, but Elwood is not a hunter or collector. The 33-year-old from Crystal was living in her car. She and her fiancé, Jeffrey Paul Jackson, were purchasing firearms from shops around the Twin Cities, selling them on a legal market, federal prosecutors say. By the end of the month, three of the guns had already been confiscated by police in connection with shooting investigations, according to an affidavit underlying the felony federal charges. A guns crime is surged in the Twin Cities over the past year. The schemes like this, known as straw purchasing, play a critical role in how legal firearms hit the streets, said Jeff Reitz, assistant special agent in charge of the Bureau Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms and Explosives St. Paul office. No one knows how many illegal guns come from straw purchasers, but local ATF agents are seeing an increase in the cases in tandem with the crime wave. Federal prosecutors in Minnesota are currently investigating four straw purchasers, in addition to Elwood, responsible for collectively putting more than 100 guns on the streets. And the Minnesota Assistant U.S. Attorney Amber Bennett, Deputy Chief of the Firearms and Violent Crime Section, these are guns that are making it into the streets and they're killing people. It's a typical straw purchase scenario. The buyer has no felony conviction, although they're de facto qualifying them from owning a firearm. But they are already really buying it for someone else who is either legally ineligible or doesn't want a paper trail for the weapon. Straw purchases are illegal under Minnesota and federal law, and investigators say they can be difficult to identify while balancing the rights of legal gun owners. Well, okay, if someone's buying 47 guns in a very short period of time, how in the freaking hell is that not a red flag? I don't care if they're buying it for someone else. That is a mistake in the system. Because you shouldn't be trying to outfit a military in Central America without raising an eyebrow or two. But, of course, and we should be furious at this. Because as much as people get mad at the gun crimes when people shoot someone, the reality is, here's the enabler. That crime probably wouldn't have happened if not for these people getting the guns and giving them to the people that are committing the crimes. And you can make the argument, well, they didn't pull the trigger. No, they basically enabled the crime to happen by giving the weapon to the person who did it. They are no different than the criminal. As a matter of fact, I'd make an argument they're worse because they are supplanting how many different crimes? This woman and her boyfriend are guilty of how many crimes? But will a Republican get mad at them at all? Hold on. Elwood and Jackson evaded suspicion for months by shopping at different gun stores. According to court documents, on May 27th, law enforcement confiscated a gun from a suspect in a shooting early in the month. The ATF discovered Elwood had bought the firearm 15 days earlier. Representative Jeremy Munson, Republican of Crevice Lake, said he believes licensure laws are wrong. I would never support a bill like that because that's a gun registry. Every gun registry in history has been followed by mass gun confiscation. Shut up. No, it hasn't. No, it hasn't. That's your paranoid delusion, you moron. But once again, how quick does it happen? The a guy like Jeremy Munson constantly criticizes when gun crime happens, especially when it's black people committing it. We've got to rein those people in. They get the gun. But the person who is supplying guns to not just one crime, not just two crimes, but 47 crimes. Well, you know, that person has a right as a buyer that, sure, they want to build up their own military. That's just America. How can we get in the way of that? This is why we cannot trust the Republicans at all. They can't look at this and say, "Holy God, that's wrong. We should not allow that to happen." They can't look at that protesters getting run over. They go out and they write bills about protesters. They can't go on. Mitch McConnell comes out and says, "We're not going to pass bills that or allow the Supreme Court justice to get approved either next year, next election, or the year after that." Dear God, they have failed us, and they always will take the side of chaos. And I'm tired of it. We're back tomorrow. Till then, see ya.